Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, December 19th. This morning, we check in with Governor Josh Green. He just released his proposed budget this week, but there are still some wild cards out there that could impact the bottom line. We reflect on Maui's recovery from deadly wildfires as we prepare to bid aloha to 2024. A surf film making the festival circuit shares the story of pulling together in times of need. And we learn about a new book whose proceeds are helping to rebuild the Lahaina Public Library. How Big Hearts on a Little Island is one author's way of giving back to the community. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A federal government shutdown looms as Congress goes down to the wire on a Friday night deadline to deal with the budget. Closer to home, Governor Josh Green this week released his proposed spending plan as the legislative session opens next month. We spoke with Green this morning about his state priorities and the political climate in D.C.
Well, I think that people need to realize that we put together a very solid budget, which is flexible enough to meet all of our needs, especially housing and affordability with the tax breaks. But we're watching the federal government very carefully because they're in turmoil as of this moment, and it's not at all certain where they're going to land because they are threatening to make cuts, across the nation. So we've asked our entire team to prepare for potential cuts from the federal government side. We've left enough monies in reserve to be safe. Our carryover balance is, as of this moment, $1.08 billion for fiscal year 25, $1.05 billion for fiscal 26, and $1.29 billion for fiscal year 27, giving us some breathing room in case. And, my basic position is we have to focus on the priorities, like I've said many times, and then we have to also make sure that we don't remove any working people. We already have pretty significant vacancies. We have about a 24% shortage across all government. It used to be 27%, so we decreased the vacancy rate by 3% over these last 2 years, but that's still one in four almost are vacant positions, and we need people to be able to do the work. So we're really watching things carefully, and we have some new priorities, of course, like a global food security program, which we will do over 5 years. And there are some challenges. We have to do a little better on protecting children because child protective services and foster services have been, underfunded to a degree. And we have to be really thoughtful about supporting them.
We have watched our homeless situation grow, lots of mental health needs. And I know the state just opened up some housing out in Wahiawa.
Yes, that's exactly right. To expand housing there, to expand extra services for those who have been desperate for housing there is special. Our general approach is to spread out the housing services and the homeless services evenly statewide so no one community feels that they've been singled out to overwhelm them in their community, but also that no community is left behind and not having services. So that's really how I'm approaching it. And, I think it's working, but it's a lot of work, and that's our job, to make sure this works out for all of the regions.
I was driving out on the west side recently, and I was really surprised to see so many homeless camps along the beach again. We were successful in finding alternative spots for folks, but that number is up again. Anything you can share about plans for the west side there?
So we're building some additional kahale on the west side, and we'll be announcing them and doing the launches of them, the functional operational launches in January. So we're at 16 kahale so far, but you will see more in West Oahu, and you'll see more on the neighbor islands in the coming year. So far, we have 563 beds for people in kahale. It will actually increase to over 1,500 by the time this first term is done. So they need just a lot of support. And of course, a vacuum was left when Twinkle passed away. And that
Twinkle
created
Borges.
Some chaos.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And she was one of our heroes in this space. So We have to do all these things. We're getting creative. We're partnering with some private entities. Of course, we're always making state land available for use when it's appropriate. So we keep going. It is a labor of love, but it's very inexpensive compared to the cost of people being on the street. And that means that we can afford it. We have put in the budget a total of $50 million each of this year and next to support the growing services. But the projection is it will save $450 million over 6 years because of people not needing to be with their families on the street and seeing emergency room doctors and so on. So the program, I believe, is a very thoughtful one, and we get better each year. That's the best part of it. Each Kauhale is better than the last.
Well, you know, it is hard, you know, during the holidays to see so many people unsheltered. We're grateful for the facilities that there are to meet the needs of families, you know, because you don't want to see, you know, young children out on the streets. And I know that's been a big priority. I know just for the average, you know, working families, affordability is such a big deal. You know, we are seeing proposals for everything from, you know, raising the fees for the bus and rail and the sewer fees, you know, those kinds of very basic government services. I know that's city side, but still just the affordability thing is just weighing heavy on people's minds.
Yeah, it's true. Well, that's why people should look no further than the major tax break that comes on January 1. So we're cutting the state's taxes in a historic way. Essentially, across all groups, taxes will decrease by about 71%. And at the same time, we are seeing about a 4.1% increase in income, so across the board. So what it means is essentially one example. You'll see a family of four who are making 88 grand and struggling to pay their rent or mortgage. They'll see their income tax liability drop from $5,086 to $1,473. So that's like $3,600 a year or $300 a month over the course of this tax break. And that is meant to really be meaningful. And it could be even larger for some families. So that combined with building enough housing so that rents come down, that's the current plan. But I will also do what I can to keep other fees away from our local people. Like as we talk about climate impact fees and those kind of services, those would be on travelers that come to Hawaii, so they won't hit our local families. It's very important that people understand that because we want to care for our environment, but we can't add any extra cost, at least at the state level, to people's lives. And I'll constantly do what I can to keep other political leaders from raising taxes or fees too much. They're trying to cover their costs and deal with the absolute necessities of their government. But most of the taxes were pegged at the state level, and so I'm going to keep dropping them.
We did hear a lot of concern about the condo insurance market. You have any update on where the task force is at?
I do. Apparently, the increases have really begun to level off because people know that what we're going to do is, you know, we are going to take some resources, for example, from the Hurricane Relief Fund and continue to make them available for emergencies. We also intend to allow the state to kind of reinsure or backstop some potential high costs, but that's going to take a successful move with these climate impact fees or use of the rainy day funds insurance and interest growth. So that grows about $60 million to $65 million every year, and it can be magnified if you do it with the mechanisms that are called securitization. The big picture, though, we would like to provide a layer of protection so that condos don't see these big surges in insurance premiums. And it's tough because we're dealing with a global market way bigger than just Hawaii. But I think the insurance industry has to acknowledge that we're providing extra protection. Therefore, the premiums should be lower.
On the topic of insurance, switching to medical insurance, I know we recently talked with Dr. Jack Lewin, who is, you know, with your administration, and he's been looking at ways to try and be innovative to make our systems work better and to get better data. Anything else you want to share on that front?
I do, actually, yes. So we're trying to streamline the admin side of health insurance so that healthcare providers and all of our patients don't have to wait or be rejected or have prior authorization delays. So that is important. It's something that I think there's going to be a kind of an increased urgency. The shooting is tragic just because no one should ever face violence, period. It's horrible that anyone would be subjected to violence. At the same time, I understand the frustration of the nation. nation is frustrated that corporate leadership has gotten a little bit aloof and out of control. Again, it would never justify an act of violence, but active protest is appropriate and freedom of speech is appropriate. And so people should be speaking up. And I'm encouraging all of the health insurers to make things easier. And frankly, it can decrease costs if we're thoughtful about it. I think there just was a bit of lethargy on that subject, and it resulted in a tragedy. So Jack is a cool guy. He's got a lot of experience, and I'm going to continue to let him work on ways to streamline our health system for our patients.
Anything else you want to share just on the healthcare front?
Well, over time, we will be launching some additional initiatives to guarantee health insurance for every child. We've gotten close on a few occasions, but Jack and I are beginning the process of working through that. We'll have a lot of extra detail for you in the coming years. And then beyond that, we are going to be expanding our healthcare safety net. So there's early discussion about expanding a new hospital in Kona, and we're making sure that we are careful about, again, spreading our facilities in a good way to protect everyone's access to care. Hawaii is the health state. We have the best healthcare access in the country, even though it sometimes doesn't feel that way. We do, and we're going to continue to pay back the loans through our HELP program to social workers and doctors and nurses and psychologists, all of these groups, so that we have more and more providers so you don't have to wait and you don't have to be afraid you can't get your prescription or whatever it is that you might need as a patient. So we're going to be the only state in the country that repays anyone's healthcare debt they've been trained. We'll be the only state that gets there 100% of the way. It will take me through about 2030 to get there. I might be able to get it done by 2028 if I'm given the opportunity to continue to serve and do this. But it helps us all, because if you get a family doctor or a nurse practitioner into a rural area, they can care for thousands and thousands of people. And getting rid of their $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 debt, but getting a commitment from them to serve, is a good trade-off.
You know, lots of progress being made on, healthcare across the state and services to the neighbor islands. Well, we are going, down to the wire with Congress and the budget. Yeah. It seems like we do this, every year. Any thoughts on that and on the nomination process for Trump's appointees?
Yes, I will likely be in Washington, D.C. in early January to share my feelings about some of the nominees, particularly RFK Jr. and his unfortunate, inappropriate nomination. He should not serve as HHS secretary because he doesn't believe in public health and prevention. So I'll be pushing very hard. He caused indirectly the measles epidemic in Samoa by scaring people there, and then providers were unable to deliver care. So I'll be in D.C. The federal government needs to stay open. I know that they are now going to be driven very hard by President Trump and Elon Musk, apparently, who's kind of running a shadow government right behind President Trump, which I am very surprised that the president's tolerating for now. He's not that kind of guy to tolerate someone trying to manipulate when he likes to be the one that makes decisions. So I'm going to be over there, and I will work with them and share just some honest reality with them about healthcare. The feds are likely to come to a deal in the coming days, but it might have a bumpy spot over this weekend. We absolutely need them to do the disaster relief money so that we can care for the people that suffered so much on Maui. So there's just a lot going on, and I know it's dizzying for people to hear all these things, but just don't worry, I've got it. There are going to be some moments, but Hawaii is going to come through this very well.
That was Governor Josh Green, who we talked to this morning about his proposed state budget. Green plans to travel to Washington, D.C. in January to testify on President-elect Donald Trump's nominees.
So you think you know Africa? A husband and wife duo have designed a trivia game dedicated to the continent. They're hoping it makes the world feel a little smaller.
We noticed that Americans have a very limited knowledge of Africa, so we wanted to dispel the myths.
I try my hand at the game next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1. Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years of preparing Hawaii's future business leaders for global opportunities. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Following our interview with former FBI agent Arnold Launui, talking about the UnitedHealthcare CEO shooting, we got this in our mailbox. I am totally puzzled by the fascination you displayed today with the hunt for the killer of UHC's CEO, but not a single mention of the concern shared by millions of Americans that UHC is likely responsible for thousands of unnecessary deaths as a result of the denial of coverage for needed medical services. Why is the media so obsessed with the search for one murder suspect, but totally ignoring the harm to tens of thousands of families caused by insurance companies that are raking in massive profits at the expense of tens of thousands of families who pay premiums but are then denied coverage? The national media, NPR, and HPR all seem to be dropping the ball here. The conversation should be about why the American healthcare system is broken, who is suffering because it's not working, and what must be done to fix it. But instead, all we hear about is that the cops found the kid who shot the chief perpetrator of a system that is victimizing the whole nation. That is news, but only a small piece of what should be the story. He is no longer a threat to anyone, but the fraud and denial of coverage continues. By missing the big story that affects all of us, the media is part of the problem instead of contributing to a national conversation that is desperately needed about fixing a system that is corrupt and does not meet our needs. And that was sent in by our listener, Bob Yonke. And, you know, we did interview Dr. Jack Lewin earlier this week. He's the head of the State Health Planning and Development Agency, and he addresses some of the concerns expressed by our listener. You can listen to that interview on the conversation page of our website. And thank you for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. You know, tomorrow we plan to hit the road to bring you stories of Maui's recovery. We'll be broadcasting live from Kula. So for today's quiz, we thought it'd be fitting to bring you the history of a popular upcountry business. The Ali'i Kula Lavender Farm was founded in 2001 after an artist with a green thumb was gifted a lavender plant by a friend. He knew all about agriculture, having grown up on a 20-acre farm in Kaneohe, and he grew that single lavender plant into a business. Even though Kula has an average annual rainfall of less than 25 inches, this founder discovered that lavender could thrive in the chronic drought conditions. The Ali'i Kula Lavender Farm is home to 20 different varieties of lavender and about 55,000 individual plants. For today's quiz, we want to know, what was the full name of the founder of the Ali'i Kula Lavender Farm, who made kula synonymous with lavender? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
When you support HPR, you support classical music and all its benefits.
Melvin Yee, neurologist here in Honolulu, longtime HPR member, your love for guitar that you're sharing for us tonight on our evening concert.
What I always tell my patients who are worried about their cognitive ability as they age, that one should always try to keep your mind active.
There are many studies about the health benefits of music on your health and well-being.
Yes, it's very peaceful and calming. And then when I play the guitar, I can just focus on that. Forget all the other concerns and just work on playing the music.
Support classical music on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Maui residents are continuing to educate the world about last year's wildfires and the recovery process. That's what producers and Kula residents Leah Warshawski and Todd Soliday are doing with their film Uncle Bully's Surf School. It focuses on the impact of surf instructor Robert Bully Cotter on a group of kids in West Maui. Cotter and his wife lost their Lahaina home in the fires just a week after closing on it. Warshawski and Soliday have been screening the film around the country from the West Coast to landlocked Kansas. HPR's Russell Subiono got a chance to talk with Warshawski about the impact of the film outside of Hawaii and the recovery in Kula.
So we still get a lot of questions about Lahaina and Maui and the fires every time we screen the film outside of Hawaii. I think people don't really understand the scale of what happened, and they don't understand how long the recovery and rebuilding process is actually going to take. So a lot of people ask us, you know, oh, so is everybody rebuilding their homes? Their new hotels that have gone up there? Are people back in their houses? The kinds of things we know by living here, you know, are pretty outrageous. But I think there's a big disconnect. And so our film opens up some questions. It allows people to ask those kinds of questions. And then it allows us to talk about what the community needs, how to help, where to send funding or donations. And just kind of gives people another view of what's actually happening here on the ground and the fact that a lot of people are really still struggling.
I imagine that you've taken the film to some places that are landlocked. Accurate.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when you've taken Uncle Bully Surf School to these landlocked audiences, what kind of experience do they have seeing life in the ocean?
Well, it was really cool, actually, when we took the film to Kansas earlier in the year. And you know, we went to a middle school, we went to a adult prison, we went to a work release program, and we went to a juvenile correction center, all in the Midwest, places where a lot of people may never come to Hawaii, have never been to Hawaii. But what they really responded to were the messages and the themes in the film. So mentorship, resilience, being an upstander, and seeing the ocean on screen is really a nice break. It's very peaceful for people. So for these people who are landlocked, who may never see the ocean, being able to watch our film and experience kind of Hawaii and surfing culture and the ocean through our film was really, really unique and cool for us to see and to be there with them. And then we always like to do some kind of community impact event along with a screening. So we screen the film, and then in some cases, we've done land lessons. So we brought Bully and Ashley to Kansas, and we didn't have an ocean to go surfing, but we did have a school gym, and we had hundreds of kids filtering through throughout the day doing surfing land lessons in the gym with Bully and Ashley. And that was cool for us to see because it helped us understand how we can bring the film to rural communities and other places outside of Hawaii. We hope to do a lot more of that And it all depends on funding. If we can raise the funds to do an impact tour next year, we'll be doing a lot more.
I have that image in my head of the kids. I imagine they're going through the motions of paddling and then popping up on the board.
Yeah, it's so cool to see the camaraderie, and everybody looks ridiculous. So you have kids who wouldn't normally be hanging out with each other, maybe from different cliques, different cultures, ages, ethnicities, and they're all, you know, making fools of themselves in the gym. They're all uncomfortable. It's not pretty. It's trying something new, and they're all cheering for each other. And it was really heartwarming for us to see that, and for us to see the power of just bringing kids into a gym and showing them something new. And everybody was talking about it the rest of the day. And the principal told us, you know, the kids won't remember much from this year, but they are going to remember this day for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Remember that time we were surfing in the gym? So awesome.
Yeah.
When it comes to last year's wildfires, Lahaina gets most of the attention, and I think we all understand why.
Right.
But Kula was also Absolutely. Significantly impacted over the same time frame. Your company, Inflatable Films, is based in Kula. Can you talk about how the fires impacted Kula most and how you see the community recovering at this point in time?
Well, we were very lucky. Our neighborhood didn't have major damage, but the neighborhoods on both sides of us did. And we know people who were forced to evacuate and didn't know if they were going to have a home to come back to. So afterwards, Kula community really rallied together. A lot of neighbors formed different kinds of organizations, different kinds of commissions, and everybody pitched in to help clean up the gulches and to help make meals for neighbors and give people rides if they needed rides, or house people if they needed a place to stay. So it really felt like the community stepped up and the community was here for each other. And it's still happening. There's still a lot of work to do and some awesome nonprofits that have sprung up because of the fires. But for us as a company, Todd and I were actually camping on the mainland when we started getting text messages from all of our neighbors asking if they wanted us to remove anything from our house or get anything from our house. And we thought, well, that's kind of weird. And so then we started looking at social media, looking at the news and hearing from other neighbors and friends. And then we understood more about what was actually happening. And within 24 hours, we were on a plane home because we just felt like we needed to be here to help and to do whatever we could for all of our neighbors in the Kula community, but also all of our friends on the west side. So we rallied a lot of our friends and colleagues in Seattle because we had lived and worked in Seattle for quite a while before coming back home to Maui. And we asked them for donations. We asked them for supplies. We talked to local hubs here in Kula, Makawao, and then Kihei, and also on the west side to try and find out what would be most helpful. What kinds of supplies do people actually need? And we used our Alaska Air Cargo account to ship over 3,000 pounds of all different kinds of supplies over to Maui. And then we would drive and distribute them to different hubs who were then getting them to the people who most needed the supplies. And we couldn't have done it without our resources on the mainland because everyone was asking us, how do we help? Where do we send money? What's a legitimate 501c3? You know, there was a lot of need, and we were in the position of trying to facilitate donations and money and supplies and figure out how they could be most helpful for everyone on the island. But looking back on it, that is what we do. I mean, we're logistics coordinators, I guess, for a living. That's what we do in the production industry. That's what I've been doing for a really long time. So I felt like, wow, this is a skill that I can use to try and do some good.
What do you think Maui wildfire survivors need most at this point in time?
I think we have friends who are survivors up in Kula and also on the West Side. And there's a few commonalities, I would say, but because we survived and our house is okay, I can only speak to what they've told us. People seem to want truth and kindness and understanding. And of course, there are people who need places to live still. They need affordable places to live, and they need money and funding and jobs to keep their lives going. So a lot of people don't have capacity to leave. They don't have capacity to build another home right away. They're still dealing with insurance and payouts and where do they want to live. And even people who are considering rebuilding in Lahaina, what's to stop another fire from coming through? Are the power lines actually going to be buried underground now? Or how are things going to be any different? And I think there's a lack of information and a lot of rumors, and people are angry, and I get that. So I think just being kind and understanding and being a friend and doing what you can and asking each person individually, what do you need? How can I help you? Because people's needs are really varied depending on a lot of different factors, and people are hurting. And so we just try and do what we can every day for each person who we meet. You know, I worked with trauma survivors for the last 20, 25 years in the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And people are traumatized. And so having some understanding that that is now part of who you are and part of how you see the world, and it will be for the rest of your life, and it's not going away. So the more you can understand about how people deal with trauma, and so just having some grace and understanding that things are going to be hard and people are going through, everyone's going through their own trauma and issues right now around the fires. Even if you're not a fire survivor, we still all live here. This is our community. And so more grace is required for sure.
That was filmmaker Olia Warshawski of Inflatable Films talking with HVR's Russell Subiono. Warshawski says they were working on two documentaries at the time of the Maui wildfires. One was Uncle Bully's Surf School. The other focused on a Kula luthier, Steve Grimes, who you heard on our show yesterday. And we will be broadcasting live on the Valley Isle tomorrow from the Kula headquarters of Inflatable Films. We'll be talking about small business recovery on Maui. Be sure to tune in. Now it's time to harvest the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the history of lavender in Maui. Despite the plant not being native to the island, it grows surprisingly well in the dry conditions of a country where some varieties can bloom year-round. The founder of the Ali'i Kula Lavender Farm grew up on a farm with fruit trees in Kaneohe. He opened his first plant business in 1976 in Nahiku on the eastern coast of Maui before selling it to a Japanese company. Then in 1999, he saw that lavender had been named the Herb of the Year and decided to open a new venture. The Ali'i Kula Lavender Farm has been in operation since 2001. You may have seen its 13.5 acres of lavender on the drive up to Haleakala, and we asked you to give us the full name of the farm's founder, who made Kula synonymous with lavender. His name, Ali'i Chang. And we stumped you on that one. No winners today. But that's our quiz. If you have one to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This Saturday on The Real Deal, the jazz side of Frank Zappa. Whether with the Mothers of Invention, the Grand Wazoo, or his later bands, he was always up to something. I'm Seth Marco. Join me Saturday from 8 to 10 p.m. on member-supported HPR1 for music by Frank Zappa.
Argentina's president Javier Milei is a self-described anarcho-capitalist. He loathes government and has promised to take a chainsaw to state spending. Who exactly is being cut down?
After the 10th of the month, I stop going to the supermarket. The bills come first, and then we'll see. I often only have tea for dinner.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Maui-based writer Victoria Moore spent a year collecting stories from nearly 200 community members who stepped up to help after the devastating wildfires. Moore was inspired by the grassroots effort and felt it was important to document the experience. The product is a 250-page book. Its title is Big Hearts on a Little Island. Moore was in Honolulu last week and sat down with the Conversation's Lillian Song to share some of the stories from that new book.
The inspiration for the book really came from boots on the ground and being part of the community effort right after the fires. I, along with my family, I had two little kids and my husband, we all just pitched in because everybody was pitching in. It was just this overwhelming flood of purpose, of needing to help in whatever way was needed, in whatever capacity we had. And so, you know, we helped in the shelters and the hubs, but what really did it, and I think the moment that I became inspired, was being up at the Kula hub. And I know, you know, the Lahaina fire is often the one we speak of, but there were four fires on Maui that day, and the Kula fire was incredibly devastating as well. And I was up there helping to clear some debris from a home that had been affected by the fires. And here next to me is this devastated home. Is just nothing but ash and gnarled metal. And we're trying to remove a lot of green waste so that there aren't continued flare-ups. There were a lot of problems with that in the days after the fire. I just remember feeling this sense of electricity in the air almost among the volunteers. And I just wanted to capture it and bottle it because it was the most diverse group of people all united in this moment of purpose together to help this family that had lost everything. There was almost a joy in a way. It was almost like our hardest days on Maui were also our best. And that might seem very strange, but you kind of had to be there to know what I'm talking about. But to see a community come together in the way that Maui did was unlike anything I'd ever witnessed before. And I've been doing this kind of work for a really long time. I started in international aid in college, really. So I got to see grassroots efforts all over the world. And as a filmmaker, I continued that work and kept traveling around the world trying to figure out who's doing it well. How do you actually help? And after about a decade of studying aid, I really came to the conclusion that two things that will change the world are grassroots efforts and probably macroeconomic change. But the stuff in between didn't seem to be having as much of an impact as I had hoped. So when I saw this grassroots effort and what it really looked like, it wasn't like anything I had ever witnessed. And it was just special. So I had this sense that we needed to record it in some way. I kept saying, I hope somebody's writing this all down. And I had that conversation with Kathleen Ageton. She's a beloved children's librarian on Maui. And she agreed with me. She said, we really need an archive of this, don't we? This is just so special. And of course, I slept on it and then realized the next day, oh, wait, I'm an author. This might be something that I will take on as a gift to my community to be able to give back in that way. So I did.
Right. Talk about the scope, the depth of voices that you were able to reach and touch.
It was a huge project. I like to say it was a labor of love. The reason it was so huge is because there were so many people helping. There were so many different kinds of helpers. And, you know, it ended up being 250 pages and 13 chapters of different ways that people stepped up. That's still the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. I mean, tens of thousands of people were volunteering on Maui. And mm-hmm. there's no way I could talk to all of them. But I did capture nearly 200. And I think I captured the essence of what we experienced in that time, of the ways that people were helping, from the first responders, both the uniformed first responders and the civilians that stepped up to help, to the people that took families in, the shelter workers who, you know, made a safe place for those displaced. Then we also had people who were restoring communication, which was actually a really big deal in those first few days. People couldn't even communicate with loved ones, you know, on the other side of the island. Right. So we had, you know, the people like the Maui Tech Hui that came together right away to be able to offer internet services for people through Starlink. And there were even like individual people. There's a man named Ryan who, you know, just brought his own Starlink to the Nepali Plaza and said, who needs to, you know, find their loved ones, and just offered himself in that way. You know, we also had a lot of beautiful efforts when it came to getting donations to where they needed to be, because once those roads were closed, there was nothing that was going to stop the people of Maui to making sure that people on the west side had what they needed. Mm-hmm. So the JAWS safety team got onto their jet skis and got over there to help ferry supplies from larger boats to land. Mm-hmm. There was even a story that I just love of Curtis Chunk. He's one of the JAWS safety drivers. He was coming back from a long day of shuttling donations, and he hit debris in the water on his way back and just went flying off of his jet ski, a huge hole in the side of his studio, and it was starting to sink, and he was like unable to breathe. And luckily, of course, he's part of the safety team, so others came and helped him. But he had broken his wrist and dislocated his shoulder. He got home, he just taped them all up and was back out there the next day. There was nothing that was going to stop him from being part of that effort because there was such a great need. And, you know, that just kind of shows you the mentality of people in that time, just being all in for the community. My job was both collecting the stories from the people, but also being able to visually tell those stories. It was really important to me that this be a community project. I knew that if you're going to document the community efforts after the fires, you were going to need the community to help you do it. And yet I knew that there's no way any of us would ever want to make money off of telling and sharing these stories. Mm-hmm. This had to all go right back to the community. So every single person on the team, myself, my designer, copy editor, every single photographer, everybody worked for free and donated their talents pro bono, just because we want all the money to go back to the rebuilding and the regrowth of the Lahaina Public Library. Mm-hmm. So that's where all the money from the book sales will go.
This is a legacy on the bookshelf, but it's also a time capsule in a sense. Now is the time to get these stories.
That was probably the hardest part of all, because as you can imagine, people didn't have their cameras out for most of this. So finding some of these photos to be able to illustrate the stories was like finding a needle in a haystack. And yet the photographers and the amateurs as well on Maui, they stepped up, and we were able to track down so many wonderful photos that could really help visually tell this story. We also had a ton of wonderful photographers who volunteered to help us shoot portraits after the fact, so we could show these local heroes after the fires and instead of actually in the midst of what they were doing. And that's a beautiful way to honor them as well.
Right. It was a grassroots effort, totally seeing the love and aloha pouring out.
Yeah, I cry a lot when I reread this book, in happy tears, but just like chicken skin type of feeling. But there's one story that always sticks out to me, which is in our final chapter, Looking Forward. And there's a Lahaina family who lost their home the night of the fires. They lived above the Pu'umana clubhouse, and the clubhouse burned down. And 2 weeks after, Kai McPhee, he remembered that they had planted this coconut tree for his one-year-old son, Aspen. And he kind of shot out of his bed, you know, 2 weeks after the fires. They've now lost everything. Aspen has just turned 2 years old, and they had planted this tree 1 year prior. And the family runs a coconut farm. So this was particularly sentimental, planted right outside of their home at Pu'umana. And so he rushes over to Lahaina, to where the National Guards blocked it off. And he said, I've got to get in there. I've got to water this tree. It's really special. It's really important. And the guy's like, you can't come in here. Like, this, we can't do this right now, you know? He's like, but it's so important. This tree is really special. And finally the cop says, ugh, I'll go water the tree. Just give me the jug. So the cop goes in, and he waters the tree, and he comes back with the biggest smile on his face. And he says, you know what? That's the first moment of hope that I've had since the fires. And that was 2 weeks after. And he was just feeling so, so good. And when Kai saw that, he said, our community needs more of that. And so what does he do? He finds a watering truck. He gets a buddy to give him a sticker that'll make him look official. And he starts Regreen Lahaina. And he goes in every single day with his little watering truck, and he waters all the residential trees. And he made it to every street. And then he started bringing community members in who had so many stories about their beloved mango tree, or all these things really meant a lot to them in terms of the trees that were in their yards. And they would come and they would water it. And, you know, a lot of the trees line are not going to make it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But there was this moment of hope. And it was also a coming together of the community. And Kai really recognized that. He said that he really missed his community. And so being able to bring them together with a shared purpose. And then, of course, I'm going to like cry now just thinking about it. But that little coconut tree is thriving. So we have a picture at the end of the book with Aspen next to his coconut tree. He's now three. And he came to the launch event 2 weeks ago. And so I got to meet him in person. And it just, it felt, you know, full circle. I can't wait to meet the coconut tree one day. I surely will meet the coconut tree. But yeah, like, what a beautiful family. And yet, I will say that, you know, they are the perfect example of that beautiful drive to give back and be creative in how they help the community. And also the fact that there are still so many problems because they haven't been able to build a house on their land. Mm-hmm. And they've been fighting the local government, trying to get permission and permits. And it's just been an uphill battle. And they're so worried that they're going to have to leave Lahaina. So as with all of these beautiful stories, you know, there's a lot of families struggling to
realities.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. really hard. So I don't want to gloss over that at all. But gosh, they are just beautiful in the way that they stepped up and found something that they could give back to the community.
Right. We're now in the season of gratitude, mm-hmm. the season of giving. And you are in Honolulu today because you were actually dropping off a set of books.
That's right. We had a book signing today, and some of the books that I brought over from Maui, I'm going to be leaving here so that people can pick them up and get their own copy. You can go to our website at bigheartsonalittleisland.com for information about how you can order those, either for pickup here on Oahu while supplies are available, or I can mail you a copy. We have shipping as well.
Mm. And Victoria, I liked how you had said also that you are leaving a legacy for the next generation, and it's beautiful on your dedication page.
Mm, yes. I dedicated the book both to the people of Lahaina and Kula, hoping that they know how embraced they are on this long road to recovery. But I also dedicated it to my two children, Andrew and Elizabeth, because this book is also for the next generation. It is for them to know that good can prevail and that at our heart, we really do care for each other. I think the state of the world can sometimes make us a bit weary right now. And I think especially in a tragedy like this, it's very easy to focus on the negative. And I definitely won't underrepresent how difficult and horrible and tragic this fire was. But even in the darkness, there is light. And I wanted to make sure that for all of the narratives going forward, that we didn't forget that there was a lot of good too. So I am definitely encouraging people to not forget, to find ways that they can continue to help, and also to remember that feeling of what it felt like to really be connected and to be purposeful and to be helpful in your own community. It felt really important to capture that while it was fresh, while we still remembered it. But it also felt really important to get it out quickly. And that's why we self-published, so we could have some control over that timeline and get it out as fast as possible. Because I want people to know right now, as their focus on Lahaina and Kula starts to wane a little bit, that the work isn't done yet. There's a lot more to do. And we don't want to forget about the affected communities. And I also want to remind them what we were capable of after that tragedy. It's kind of the world we all want to live in, isn't it? And so when we have the vitriol in our world, like, you know, surrounding us all the time, how beautiful to be able to be reminded that at our core, when things were hardest, the good prevailed.
That was Maui-based writer Victoria Moore and HPR's Lillian Song. 100% of proceeds from the sale of Big Hearts on a Little Island will go right back into the community to support the rebuilding of the Lahaina Public Library. Hard copies of the book have sold out on Maui, but Moore's taken pre-orders for the next print run, and we're told there are about 30 copies available in Honolulu at the Shinyoan Hawaii Temple on Baratania Street. We'll have pictures and links on our website. Thank you. One final note, we have some sad news to share with you here today. Former HPR president and general manager Jose Fajardo died at his home in Honolulu. He was 61 and he passed away from ALS. Jose was a lifelong fan of radio and a veteran of public media, playing a key role in HPR's development and expansion in numerous ways since joining the station in 2016. He was diagnosed with ALS, a terminal neurodegenerative disease, in 2021. He and his wife Jennifer have been vocal advocates for ALS patients and caregivers, sharing the story of his journey with the disease. For more on Jose's life, please see our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. That is it for us today. Up tomorrow, join us as the conversation goes on the road. We will be broadcasting from Kula Maui and we'll be spotlighting small businesses as they build back. Got a small business story to share? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.